With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Lightning Dogs, the official podcast presented by the Nerdist Show Network. Geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdist Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geek programming, visit nerdistshow.com. Lightning Dogs is conceived as an all-ages property, but these behind-the-scenes conversations are not all ages. So listen at your own discretion, baby. Woo!
You know, sometimes a great idea is like a bolt of lightning. And sometimes, if you're lucky enough, you can capture the exact moment when it strikes. That's what happened for us one fateful night when recording an episode of Nerdy Show. We accidentally launched a concept that derailed the entire show and, in no time, our lives. We couldn't stop talking about our favorite action figures and B-movies while twisting them into strange creatures, weird adventures, and my personal favorite, dog puns. Lots of dog puns. This is the story of Lightning Dogs, a journey steeped in the glory of 80s and 90s animation and sci-fi where anthropomorphic dogs tear through the wasteland of a ruined Earth, battling mutants, miscreants, and the evil Glampire. Coming soon to small screens, comic books, and podcasts. Or at least that's the goal. But how do you go from a crazy idea into a fully formed world of conflict and characters? How does a harebrained discussion become an animated series? That's what we're finding out firsthand. We've recorded the entire development of Lightning Dog since day one, from the moment of conception to every world-building session and planning meeting, and the journey is still ongoing. Tune in as we create the world of Lightning Dogs. Live!
Welcome to a new episode of Lightning Dogs.
It's good to be back to it. After spending so many sessions dedicated to almost exclusively building the history of the Lightning Dogs homeworld, Doug, Cap, and I were in much need of the chance to just kick back and let loose with new weirdness from the wasteland. In fact, this time we're just taking a scenic tour. What was initially just a Mad Max-style desert is starting to grow and evolve into its own character. In this episode, we discuss our expanding topography. We also make strides toward putting a pin in how exactly planet Earth got so messed up in the first place. The origin story for our world's horrific transformation and all of our peopleoid pals begins here. So why delay? Let's dive right into it. What have you got, Doug?
I had a couple of things, actually, and I wrote them down in several different documents on my phone because I had to get it out. The first one, which was the big one, was something that we've kind of brushed up against before in terms of we discussed it in very broad strokes, which was we still don't really know what the catastrophe is that turned Earth as we know it into the wasteland.
And right. We've had suggestions.
We've had a lot of suggestions, had a lot of thoughts. Like, what did it? But what was also something? Because everybody pitched in an idea that was really good. And I'm like, if there's a way we can somehow make it all happen and make it all work together, I think there might be something there. And I remember the one thing that always stuck with me was Cap was talking about the end times apocalypse prophecy, mm-hmm. the Native American prophecies. And the final one was there's a dwelling in the heavens that falls in the form of like a blue star and stuff. I remember when we talked about this on a previous episode, you said, oh, you could easily interpret that as like a space station. And then remember that developed into, oh, what if it's a space station that crashes and all this other stuff? And I was like, yeah, but why? But like, why specifically the space station? Why would it crash? You know, like, I don't really know. Like, there's nothing really that ties it all together. Then I remember talking about Glampire being involved with building like a huge Farfetch'd like on the ground that would explode and maybe somehow send the thing out of orbit. I don't know. Like, there was a lot of ideas floating around. But as I was writing down an idea, I was getting inspiration, so this is going to be more of a stream of consciousness rather than a full-fledged out like idea.
Okay.
So I'm just going to go for it. So the apocalypse begins with a giant space station crashing to Earth? Maybe a wormhole station for ships to pass through allows large groups of people to get to distant planets faster than the small Stargate-sized ones that we see on Earth's surface. Or maybe it was built as a kind of telescope or slingshot prototype that can warp large things to distant planets without a gate already awaiting them on the other side. Built too big, too fast, with too many bad crystals. So I'm going to pause there for a second just to sort of clarify what I was talking about. So far-fetched technology is like gate A, gate B, boom, you go through it. And there you have to build it on the other side and you just come through like a tunnel. What if this is a large space station that is not only a space station, but it also is a very large far-fetch that when you have ships in outer space, you can then say, well, hey, now we're no longer limited. If this works, we're no longer limited by gate A, gate B. It's almost like you just aim it where you want to go. You aim it at a distant planet, the portal, and then boom, it shoots you there.
Say place that's got a whole bunch of naturally going crystals that maybe they would name Domus down the line.
Yes, that's possible. What my thought was that if the giant space station that is built by Glampire's corporation, assuming he's in the future and he's still, you know, obviously he's still alive, but like that he somehow has the power to influence this. Glampire, what is his goal? His goal is, I need to get home. I need to get back to the Glampire planet, whatever that is. That's a whole other conversation.
The Glam planet.
The Glam rock.
Done. Cut it, print it.
I'm trying to get back to Glam rock. but I'm so sorry.
I'm not picturing the entire population as Glam rockers.
But think of it this way. There is no gate on Earth that he can build that would get back to Glam rock. I'm just going to go with it because everyone knows what it is now. So what do? You have to invent a technology that will allow you to travel great distances in short time without a gate waiting for you. So I'm using this slingshot metaphor to kind of sort of like the idea of it launches you. So if there is a space station that's basically like a ring in space and the inside fills up with the void of whatever, like the wormhole that gets ripped open, and then you just take a large battle cruiser ship and you just go through, or maybe just a colony cruiser, whatever it is, something that's large. Because with every other far-fetch that you have on Earth, you might be able to walk through it or drive through it, or maybe you could march.
But you're not going to be able to be large enough and be able to sustain that level of power.
But if you, exactly, it's like if you wanted to take 100 people through a far-fetch, there's really not enough power to do that. And you'd have to have them walk through it or drive through it, and that would take a long time. But if you were to have a large thing where you could just take a spaceship full of like 200 people and just drive through it and then immediately close it, you're saving power. And also it frees the limits of having to have a gate waiting for you.
And maybe, just maybe, because he knows the approximate distance between he and Glamrock, and he knows that it's going to take a lot of power to get him there.
Yeah.
And
so build a giant space station.
And the defective crystals he's got right
exactly,
now,
because they're from Earth,
aren't going to be enough to get him there, which
exactly.
is why he has to find, say, what becomes Domus that has these naturally growing crystals, and that's why he's having to harvest them. That gives us that waiting period, why he can't just go straight back to Glamrock using this. But he figures, do this here, and I can get the crystals I need to amass my army and return home.
Right.
He thinks he can push it. Something then happens to where either it gets used too much or a calculation was off because he was relying on stupid human math.
That was the second part of what this is, of what the actual disaster is. So that's like the setup for what's going on with the thought of like, well, obviously that's a big thing floating around near Earth and that's going to go wrong. Where I went on was, this is tying back to other stuff. Feel free, this isn't solid yet. I'm just pitching this as, again, stream of consciousness from where I left off. Major Tom went through it to chart new space, but a failure sent him somewhere in deep space by accident. Lovecraftian horror got a hold of him and started to come back through. The explosion and re-entry of the space station can spread the unnatural crystals that powered it all over the Earth. Humanity can't handle it, and what little civilization there is that survives the initial impact soon crumbles and dies out. The last thing I wrote was a potential name. I just said Space Station Hermes, because the idea is that it gets you really quick from one place to another. And that's another weird thing that the dogs wouldn't really understand. It's like a giant far-fetch, and it's like, Space Station Hermes, what the hell is that? And of course, that's not in outer space anymore. It crashed to Earth, so there's... Literally, that can explain why not just crystals are all over Earth, but the bad crystals are all over Earth. Because this is a space station as it's slowly decaying in orbit after it exploded. And that is a big catastrophic event. Bad crystals raining from the sky like a meteor shower.
Right.
That would definitely fuck you up. And not just in the physical, like it hitting things, but just electrical and mutations.
Yeah, well, and that was what we were going for, our last incarnation of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like the idea of having a big space array that acts as a gateway. Like, I mean, that's great. With the timeline we established before, didn't put humanity at that level yet, exactly. The trick is that we need to make sure in whatever scenario that happens that the Farfetch'd that the Lightning Dogs use is the last known one.
Yes.
And that's going to be tricky if humanity is far enough along or is so accustomed to using this kind of technology that they're ready to build one in space, that there's still something on the ground. And that's the trick there. What we talked about before, I believe, was the narrative of Glampire is suggesting use of these crystals as a wealthy industrialist, and he's like forcing that issue, and they're growing them in labs and stuff. And the crystals can attune to other crystals somewhere else in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the Farfetch'd that goes to Domus.
You get enough of them together, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. So you can start mining the real ones and so on. But he's trying to push the issue. He's going too fast. He's forcing them to go too fast. Mm-hmm. I believe we were talking about some kind of like a wireless energy array or something as the satellite before.
The reason that made me think of it was more of the question of, we know there's an apocalyptic event, and we know that Glampire is somehow connected to it. What does Glampire want? We know he wants to go home. How does him wanting to go home create an apocalyptic event?
Right.
Well, clearly he's in a rush and he pushes humans too far too fast. I think the Farfetch'd technology of using crystals, like, oh, we can use the crystal to detect where other crystals are. And if we get enough crystals together, we can open up a hole just big enough to send someone over there and start building a colony and using the crystals that are on Domus. We can then start farming them and mining them, get those crystals, send them back. The crystals that he's getting from Domus can go up into the space station array, and that plus all the ones that we're manufacturing on Earth, making more. They may not even know there's a difference between the ones that we make and the ones that we find naturally. Maybe they do, maybe they don't.
They probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
Or Glampire's aware that, well, yeah, they're probably not as good, but like the instabilities, like that's not his science. He doesn't know what's good or bad about the crystals. He just knows that, you know, like he knows some things.
Yeah. So his ultimate goal is, if we can build that space station in the sky that is big enough to send an army through. Granted, he doesn't have one. He doesn't have any of this stuff. But he says, if I get it big enough, if I just have a machine that is big enough where I can send anything through it, and then I aim it at Glamrock, I'm home free and nothing can stop me. I mean, and then you're like, well, why doesn't he just wait? Well, he has been waiting for thousands of years, right? And he's, you know, like, why not just wait and collect all the proper crystals to do it? Well, what if he doesn't know that there's a difference between the man-made crystals and the natural ones? The man-made ones maybe just grow slower. That's the difference. So it's like, oh, shit, we found Domus. Domus has all of the, or if they call it Cerberus 2 or whatever, Cerberus 2, Cerberus 3, they have natural growing crystals. We create a small Farfetch, go through mine, bring it all back through the Farfetch, put it up in the giant array and mixed with all the other stuff. You mix natural crystals.
It's like putting a bad battery with a good battery.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I got it mixed up. It's that man-made crystals grow faster, but are not as powerful. Natural crystals work way better, but they take forever to grow.
Right. Yeah.
And they don't grow naturally on Earth. So that's like where it's like the rush to get it. It's like, oh, we finally have a hotbed of all natural crystals. Let's throw it up into space with everything that we got. Because once that thing opens, he's home free. He's got it. He's done. So they open it up and they want to send a test thing through just to see if it goes through. The test goes horribly wrong. And then I was thinking, okay, well, how do we connect that with shutting everything down? Everyone has to evacuate. We have to shut this whole thing down. And I have talked before about the idea of they shut it down because humanity realizes we may have stepped in something that we're not prepared for. And if that's the Lovecraftian unknown horror that creates Space Boy, they can see that happening and go, whoa, that's fucked up. Shut it down. Don't let it get to Earth. Now, this opens us up to another couple of options of what could happen. Either some of that unknown space horror comes to Earth, or maybe they shut it down before it comes to Earth. If it does come to Earth and it lands on Earth, that could explain some of the freaks. Like, you take these unknown horror alien things that have fallen to Earth from who knows where. That mixed with crystals and Earth life could create really crazy monsters. Or we just cut it off. And none of that alien crap lands on Earth, but it's already too late because the crystals are spread everywhere. I see a lot of potential options and story avenues to take. And this also gave me the idea that when they're shutting it down, it's like, you know, they send out a signal, code black, everybody has to return to Earth. And all the other outposts where they were exploring and doing mining, everyone has to return back. And on Domus, when they're returning back, they close it off thinking, well, maybe we don't know the nature of the emergency, maybe it's obviously really bad if they're using this code, so we'll shut it all down. Maybe we'll be back in a couple of years, depending on what the problem is. But I remember we talked before on another episode about, were there any humans left behind on Domus?
Yeah.
And I thought, man, wouldn't it be an interesting story to follow the person or small group of people who said, no, this is my new home. I came out here to colonize it. this is our way of life. I don't want to go back to Earth. If there's a code black or whatever it is, like if there's a code, whatever, return code, that means something bad has happened. I don't have any family back home. I need to stay here. Here's my family. Or I think I got the inspiration from that Japanese man who is going back to the radiated areas after the, was it Fukushima, who goes into those villages that are affected by the radiation and takes care of the animals. He literally was like, he went in there and he's like, some of these dogs are locked up in these houses. They were there for months. Some of them didn't make it. And some of them who did, I've been feeding them and nursing them back to health. And people have been donating money because he's irradiated now.
Yeah.
So he's like, now I have something in common with these household pets and some horses and other like animals. He's kind of like Noah's Ark kind of thing, except all he's doing is caretaking for these animals. He's irradiated. The animals are irradiated. They have this weird thing in common. And he has like a wife and kids. And sometimes they'll come out to help, but he makes sure that they stay far enough away so that they don't get sick and everything. Mm-hmm. Fascinating story.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, yeah, I can easily see
something like
somebody
that.
Staying behind.
Not to mention, it would explain a lot of why were the animals left behind. If it was families who were sticking around and their pets were there.
Yeah. Because first of all, we don't even know how many humans are on Domus before they leave. We never really talked about it. We know it's a colony of some kind.
Probably like 1 to 2,000, something like that.
Yeah, if it's sort of large, like 1 to 2,000, it's like, everybody abandoned, we've prepared for this, we've done drills, everyone threw the Farfetch, and someone's just like, I don't, but what about Fluffy? And it's just like, don't worry, I'm staying behind, I'll take care of all the dogs, don't worry. You did like that sort of thing, where it's like, human safety is our number one concern, you need to get out of here. And the person or people who are left behind, that is an amazing story. That to me can be a story that's like its own comic book. Or it's its own radio show.
It could even head into some of the tribalism based on what region these people were staying in, what dogs they were taking care of.
Because the idea that if you have a human or multiple human caretakers for these animals, that can explain why if everything was shut off and abandoned, like in the blink of an eye, how do the dogs just find these preserved human things? But if humans were there for maybe another 10, 15 years, 20 years,
before they all
still living in the laboratory, still living in the living quarters.
And then they could even start to.
And the humans are aware of their own mortality. They know, well, I'm going to die. And humans haven't contacted us back from Earth. Something bad must have happened. But in the hopes that one day humans will come back, I'm going to keep the Farfetch intact. I'm going to keep it powered down so that when they do come back, it can turn on from the other side. Blah, 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 blah.
And these could also be the record keepers who are actually keeping records of this master civilization. It would explain why, because if this guy, maybe they even start to see the development starting to happen within these dogs, the increased cranial capacity and so forth and so on, so they would want to leave records behind.
Mm-hmm. And the sort of backstory of being loyal to masters, and masters always being like almost magic in the sense, like there's this connection of that they were taking care of us, but then one day they were gone.
Yeah.
Like this would really cement that in their.
Here's the thing. Now, a couple people being left behind, I think could be made to make sense, but if there's someone who's intentionally creating journal entries or whatever pertaining to the fall of humanity on that planet or whatever, or the mystery of what happened or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a position where the dogs would be given too much information.
That is a thing I was worried about, but we could just explain any of it away with, they don't know why there was an emergency callback.
Or, hell, why shy away from the trope that does get played up a lot, which is people in a position of power keeping secrets. Top level knows what's going on, and they know a hell of a lot more than they're telling anybody, including their quote-unquote most trusted lieutenants.
This is the problem that we had when we were, and this is not even a problem, but this is just the same gap in story that we ran into when we were doing Microscope, which is, what do the general population of dogs know about masters? And what do the higher up people who are definitely keeping secrets, what do they know? I don't want either one to know too much. I don't even necessarily want any of them to even know what masters look like, because I think there could be a very poignant moment in a future Lightning Dogs episode or comic issue or whatever, what have you, whatever form it takes, where they finally get to see an image of masters for the first time, where it's like they may have known, oh, they walked upright, we can tell that they had hands because of the way these machines are built, but we really didn't know what they really looked like.
Well, I mean, like that would mean that there'd be no files, because any digital content left over had to have had images.
Yeah, but with the degrading quality of how whatever it's stored on or however it's encrypted. I mean, we're talking technically thousands of years of development on this dog planet. Who knows? I mean, I think the point being is that there's a lot of options. All we have to do is decide, what do they know? What do they not know? And then from there, we can build out why they know that or don't know that.
If I feel pretty much in the camp of like we should err on the side of extreme mystery. But also that if you just look at our technology now, it would be virtually impossible for us to occupy any space for even a couple months without leaving enough material that could be, by a civilization of equal technological integrity, somehow picked apart or archived or something, you know, especially if like it was future humans. So, you know, you got to figure that every piece of hardware would at least be a solid state drive or something like that's really pretty good at holding that information.
Mm-hmm. Have 7 or 8 Instagram accounts that somehow survived.
There'd be materials there. I suppose the one thing that'd be a more recent development of Dogkind is based on the evolution of Dogkind's technology, that they would be able to unlock those secrets and that maybe the public knows what humans look like, but at least someone does know what they look like. Mm-hmm. But as far as the information that Earth was doomed or there was a code, whatever, a code black was,
they probably don't know that.
They shouldn't. They probably shouldn't know that. And then if we're talking about like multiple people existing on Domus, well, you got to figure that the increased evolution of the crystals would be just as influential on humans as it would on dogs. So either they evolved or de-evolved into a species that's entirely different from humanity, or actually, much like Homo sapiens and Cro-Magnons actually are part of the dog lineage and the dogs don't know it, or something like that, where like interbreeding was possible at some point. But basically, if there's a male and a female human on there, chances are there would be progeny at some point.
That's why when I was thinking of it, I was thinking it would probably be, if it was one person, that would explain why they would just die out and really not have any change, and they wouldn't leave a lot of evidence behind. Because like I say, if you had a male and a female, after the 5-year mark, it'd be pretty clear that no one's coming back and they need to just continue living. And this world was decent enough to live on for a colony, so we may as well just continue on in that direction. But if they had a family... And we did talk about this in another episode as I was listening back. And I think maybe even to me, that was just like, well, what if his, you know, what if he becomes infertile because of the crystals? Or like, just, right. I mean, there's any explanation we can give, but
we've got a planet full of MacGuffins.
Yeah, we can choose any direction. But I think ultimately it's just, what is the catastrophe? What is the details of that? Then we figure out, based on what really happened, how much is known. The other quick note that I had of an idea when I was listening to a previous episode is you were talking about the Echo Building.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, well, what do we do with that? It's kind of like a fortress. It's like out in the desert and stuff like that. And then I just thought, oh, what if that's where Halloween Jack is? Like him and his cronies. What if they just inhabit the Echo Building?
Yeah, totally.
So it seems like a fortress, but that still ties into him living on top of Manhattan Chase. Because it is a skyscraper, but it's not really a skyscraper if it's buried up in sand to where it just looks like a, you know, like a 3-story fortress.
Yeah. No, that's totally doable. I suppose the one question would be, in the process of developing the world of the wasteland and the topography of the wasteland, does it make sense for Jack to have something like that at his disposal, or should he be in the...
Nomadic?
He wouldn't be nomadic because he's the sheriff of Nottingham of whatever region that is exactly. But like, you know, is that where Jack's people are based out of, or are we going to have like, you know, above ground townships or something and have that be something more formidable, like Gastown in Mad Max or something like that, you know? It's basically, it's there if we want it. I love the Manhattan Chase comparison.
I'm going to go on record and just argue on in favor of it, because at this point, ride style over practicality.
Right, but there's so much we haven't even created yet. It just happens to be one of the few things we have. I'm not in any rush to pin it down.
See, really. It seems like a fitting place for, because we want Holly Jack to be a credible threat.
Right.
So let's give him a fortress. Let's fill it with freaks. And that's like the one thing.
Let that freak flag fly.
Yeah, technically I don't want to say it's completely impenetrable, but it's definitely a thing where if it was just like a spread out sprawl of camps and tents and stuff, the lightning dogs could just, you know, like run through it and fuck shit up. But if it's like embedded in this building and the building goes down another 100 stories and it's filled with creatures living in the dark and the dim caverns of this skyscraper buried in the sand, you wouldn't really want to take it over. You know what I mean? Like from the outside,
leave enough alone.
Yeah. You need to perform a root canal on a skyscraper scale.
You have that moment where maybe they do decide to storm it. And as they get in, Narisa's checking out. And she's like, guys,
this goes on for a long time.
It goes on. It goes.
Yeah.
How far? Deep.
I can't see the bottom. Yes. And it'd be a great place for the Lightning Dogs RPG if you want to do some dungeon crawling. The place.
It's a great opportunity for stories. I guess my one question is, like, if you look at the Echo Building as either a castle or a labyrinth or something like that to be stormed at some point, you know, that might be too good for Jack.
No, frankly. I agree. If we think of a great mystery for them to delve into, I think that's a perfect place, but I don't want it to go unused.
Right. Oh, no. It won't. I'm just saying, like, we have so much more work to do on the World of the Wasteland. I mean, we should spend a whole episode, you know, looking over our reference material for it and just coming up with, like, oh, wouldn't this be a cool place? And being like, all right, let's make sense of this. Let's figure out what this is. What is this? You know, like, right. How does it work?
It just hit me that I realized that the Echo Building, someone would be living on top of a skyscraper. And if anyone in the Lightning Dogs universe should live on top of a skyscraper,
it's Jack.
Oh, it's Jack. Now, I'm not married to the idea because I do agree that we need to not do things just because David Bowie once said it.
There are so many other pop stars.
I love it. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love putting little nods here and there, but we separated ourselves from Thundercats a long time ago.
Yep.
And David Bowie is a fantastic inspiration and incredible musician.
But it's time to move
musician.
On to Billy Idol Island and
Billy Idol Island.
Absolutely, it's a nice day to start again.
But there's so much, like, we literally have, the whole world is open, so let's
step outside a little bit.
We don't have to have appropriation from other pop culture influences.
It's funny because one of the things that I was thinking about a lot was just how much, because I've seen a decent amount of terrain in my travels throughout my life, but it's easy to forget what else is out there. And you're talking about, you know, we've taken a lot from Bowie, we've taken a lot from this, but there is a whole world out there. And that can be really overwhelming. Like, I went to this place, San Juan Bautista in California, which is just south of San Francisco. And just in that area, you're seeing mountains, you're seeing valleys, you're seeing rural flat areas like maybe you would find in Middle America or the northern parts of the East Coast. But you drive a little bit further out and you've got nothing but cliffs. You drive a little bit further north and you're just in the forests. There is so much. This place is fucking huge. And it's easy to forget just how big it is because we just concern ourselves with our day to day. So on the one hand, we do need to take into consideration how large everything is because it gives us a lot of freedom.
We literally have the whole world.
We literally have the whole world. But at the same time, I think we need to narrow down where the Lightning Dogs actually takes place. Where is their day-to-day?
America.
Well, I know it's America, but what? America is fucking huge, dude!
Well, I think we established much earlier that we didn't want to pin the Lightning Dogs down to any particular place. You know, it's not a story about a post-apocalyptic New York. You know, like, even though the Echo Building is reminiscent of the Chrysler Building, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's not. And the continental drift has happened and the disasters have happened, so
we could say anything.
Yeah, it's not a discernible terrain. We don't need to know where they are.
If I was pressed to say, I would say North America, probably Middle America, like Kansas or Oklahoma.
Though that completely gets rid of all, well, potentially gets rid of all the different coastal things that we've talked about.
Well, they would have to get to the coast. Yeah.
But to that end, let's not limit ourselves in the stories we can tell, but we need to narrow the focus.
You know where it is? Springfield, USA.
Okay, that's perfectly fine with its four neighboring areas
everywhere.
Of San Francisco, New York.
It is an equal distance
Orlando,
to anywhere
Florida.
In America.
But let's start to define that. Let's start to define their stomping grounds. Mm-hmm. Because unless they've got a plan in mind, because we've discussed giving them a home base, mm-hmm. which a home base implies an area out of which they operate, we are starting to run into the fact that the entire world is there for us to create. And we don't need to create it all at once. So let's focus on what needs to get fleshed out and then start to build from that. Let's get a starting point. Because right now we've jumped from Antarctica to Japan to mm-hmm. the Arctic itself mm-hmm. to the coasts to New York to Middle America to Canada to Transylvania, where Glampire obviously operates out of.
That's the other thing. We still have so much about Glampire that we don't know. And we do mm-hmm. want to keep a mystery. So we need to figure out, maybe not necessarily where he is, but definitely more of what he's currently up to. What's the status quo of a normal day? As far as the Lightning Dogs traveling and seeing the world, I always thought that when we start Lightning Dogs, they're kind of limited to one area where they do have a home base.
Yep.
And that's like maybe where they destroyed the Farfetch, or maybe not, because if they destroyed the Farfetch,
why stick around? It's kind of,
yeah,
the people are going to know they're there.
Exactly.
Right. And originally I'd wanted them to be based out of there, but then I realized that was just pointless because of the disaster that creates their powers.
It's like, essentially lighting a torch and then sitting next to it.
But the way I see it is there's about 100-mile space that they exist in with Glampire, and Glampire makes a case really early on for why they should be concerned about him, why he's the primary threat. So they're guarding a couple things. One, they know that they were near, you know, the location of a Farfetch. There may be others nearby. They're not sure what that means exactly. Two, Glampire, he's a very important person. Mm-hmm. That he might not be the only power player on Earth, but he has something in mind.
He has a plan.
Yeah, he's an imminent threat, and he clearly has something going on because he's growing all those crystals, and there's probably no one else on the planet who can say that they're doing that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
So they know that the ruins of their only way home are in that area. Their biggest threat is in that area. So the Lightning Dogs aren't necessarily going to go on globe-trotting adventures.
At least not at first.
At least not at first.
Maybe season one is them trying to figure out just what they need to do in order to get there.
In order
something
to survive.
Happens at the end of season one, season two, that they wind up having to go on a globe-trotting trip.
That's kind of where I was getting at.
I'm in no rush to send them around the world because, you know, you talk about how, well, we're talking about Antarctica and Japan and all that, but that's nothing. Those are just like story points, and those are just origin places for characters. Characters who inevitably have a reason to come to where the Lightning Dogs already are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm really not, like, we can flesh out the rest of the world in our own due time. But I'm not particularly worried about that. I think what we need to focus on are the wasteland vistas of, let's say, a 100-mile region of destroyed America. And that's okay. As much detail as we need to give it, because the more specific we get, the more we reduce our ability to be creative about it and to really challenge ourselves to come up with something unique.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that we need to specify a part in America. We're on the same page, Cap. We're just reading from different editions of the same volume.
I would only say North America, not because I live there, but
what you know, Doug.
Right. Yeah. Well, but it's a large enough space that
we could have 100 to 200 miles.
That has the terrain can change reasonably and in an interesting way. By North America, I'm like including Canada and everything above. So because there's no maps, you know what I'm saying? There's no outlines, there's no states, there's no anything. It's just a chunk of land that if you go from east to west, the terrain changes in interesting ways. You go north and south, same thing. So any direction you choose, interesting things can happen.
We're also dealing with a lot of themes surrounding certain aspects of America and Americana, like Wolfman Jack and the Hot Rods, and even Glampire's former status as a power-hungry industrialist. Not exclusive to America, of course, but we've got a reputation.
And the wild buffalo tyrannosaur dinosaur.
The Buffasaurus.
All that fun stuff. Buffasaurus, yeah.
So let's start hashing out some of those vistas. I mean, a couple of places that have always stood out to me. I really want a coastal region. Want a coastal region, if for no other reason than just to have it there as a looming area where we don't go. I think that's important. I think it's important to have not only a place where they traditionally do go, but also where they don't, so that if they do wind up there for any reason, we know that something's gone wrong. What kind of terrain? I mean, do we picture? I've always pictured like mountains in the distance, some kind of cave formations as we talk about the wasteland. Are we picturing kind of a rocky terrain? I mean, what kind of stuff do you guys have?
You know, it's gone back and forth with me between like that Mad Max desert where it's just basically sand.
You know, when we started this, a Mad Max film was not even a possibility.
Yeah. And then
Fury
all of a
Road
sudden,
came
Fury
along.
Happened, and it's just like,
and
great.
It was marvelous.
It is great, but it's just like, oh man, now.
Now we've got those inevitable comparisons.
Yeah. Our homage to Mad Max that was such a focus on the story isn't quite as clever anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe, what if it's just more of an American desert? Where it's more a little more rocky than, say, the Mad Max. I mean, Mad Max had canyons and stuff like that.
So maybe someplace kind of like.
I mean, what about, you know, Arizona?
I was going to say
Arizona, Nevada, something like that.
Like the Painted Desert. Now, granted, in real life, the Painted Desert has tons of life, you know, and plants and flora and fauna of all kinds.
Oh, well, this does too.
Right, but it could be, that's the thing. It doesn't have, like, originally when we were discussing Lightning Dogs, it was more of like a lifeless, sand-blown wasteland. Whereas now I'm thinking it's still technically a wasteland, but there can be cacti and all this other stuff, but weird kinds that we've never seen before.
And through the virtue of the inevitable giant divide that's going to remove California from the rest of the states, gives us that coast because it's right in that same region.
I mean, if we want to look at global shapes, we've got projected sea levels for the next, like, you know, few hundred years. So we can go to the most extreme version of that and
just see what pops up.
Yeah. And then like, let's say the sea levels rose because that probably happened before humanity even, you know, did the far-fetched stuff. So that they've already coped with that. They've already dealt with all that
new
stuff.
New beach housing available.
So
contact your realtor today.
You know, so that's already said, you know, over and done with. But then the disaster happens and then we're seeing biomes where there wouldn't normally be biomes. We could invert the poles if we wanted to. you know, we can do whatever. We can take this like sea level risen map of the world and then just use the smudge tool on it and be like, hey, we want a little bit over there and just sort of stretch it all around.
Yeah. And again, we don't have to be 100% accurate to any of that stuff. It just makes it interesting. Just like, again, like saying, okay, well, Mad Max did that. We don't want to be Mad Max. We don't want to try and outdo what Mad Max did. We want to make it different and interesting. Well, Mad Max is in that sandblasted desert. Let's give him a desert full of life. And it's just different. And that also opens it up to there's more things to see and do.
Not to mention, the idea of a clear, flat area leads to an ever-present sense of tension.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can see the threat literally looming on the horizon at any time, knowing that it's out there...
And it's still moving to you,
I mean, it was something that they did do in Fury Road, and we don't necessarily need to emulate it entirely.
But we're talking like an Arizona-style desert, huge rock structures, all that fun stuff. You could have another flat area that's just not a desert, say, the American Plains.
Yeah, stand-up comedian once said that, you know, his dog ran away from him in Arizona, and he got to watch him leave for 3 days.
That's a pretty good one.
So, I mean, same sort of idea. So we've got that. We've got, obviously, some cliffs, and I think the kind of... Oh, what's the name for those?
Grand Canyon?
Buttes?
The Buttes, yes.
The mesas?
The Buttes and the mesas. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing, I think, would make for some excellent either cave-dwelling societies.
Also, just great imagery. I mean, hell, fucking Cap, you remember, we're talking about the Kansas album cover.
Yeah, Monolith.
That's straight out of the American West.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my vision for Lightning Dog since day one, practically. Yeah,
and that's basically what we're talking about now. So,
and for me, it switched between that and more palette swapped. Like, whenever you picture like the American Midwest and that being destroyed, it's always very orange, warm hues. And when you picture, say, the East Coast, anything on the East Coast, for whatever reason, winds up being drenched in the light blue, very drab, very cold. Because I know mostly the East Coast, when I default to, say, a destroyed city or something like that, I picture it there.
Who else here has been reading The Walking Dead?
I've read The Walking Dead forever, yeah.
Yeah, so then you guys already can see what I'm talking about, where it's like when they go on their trek, they have harsh winters. They start in Georgia, right? In like the fucking swamp. And then they move their way up north towards, making their way towards D.C. And they have like this harsh winter that they have to go through. And then like a normal spring afterwards. But I mean, of course, there's zombies. But you see what I'm saying? It's like there's...
Of course.
There's a lot of... And it's
nobody's,
all in a...
Nobody's discounting the zombies.
Yeah, it's all in a broken down post-apocalyptic suburban America, basically. Urban and suburban America. There's a lot of fun stuff. We're not the only ones to notice this. There's a lot of fun stuff that can be had there.
When the dogs, like, you know, actually see Earth for the first time, it needs to look like a worst case scenario.
For sure.
We can get into like to weird forests and all the other stuff, but I feel like a scorched Earth that's reminiscent of like nuclear holocaust is important to maintain.
That's their first impression.
Yeah. That everything is dead.
Yeah. They're like, they come here thinking, hey, if we're lucky, maybe we'll meet a master. Maybe we'll get the secrets and unlock, you know, all the answers we wanted to know, all the Dogkind has wanted to know for years and years. But then they get here.
And maybe we'll die of dehydration. Yeah.
But they get here and it's just confusion of like, why would they lead us here? Why here? What is this place? There's nothing can live here. But of course, you explore a little further out, you start to find all kinds of crazy stuff.
To that end, we've got a coastal region we know we've got, and we know the basic makeup. What are some other vistas that we need?
Well, we talked about jungles and Antarctica for the distance stuff.
We're looking at this desolation, this combination of modern stuff destroyed with kind of grim, weather-worn natural landscapes and so on. And then also the inclusion of buildings built by the creatures that came after mankind.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much for us to work with here. There's spin-offs of modern architecture, spin-offs of ruined future architecture, maybe let's say medieval or gothic style structures that the other creatures are capable of building, which would be hinged very strongly on recycling the things left over by the future structures and so on.
I already thought of a location that's purely tied to Captain Scrap, and I don't know where it is, but what the location is like Pirates of the Caribbean style hidden sea cave that you can sail a ship into, then the tide rises and then no one can get in, and then you wait for the tide to go down, then you can leave again. But inside is like a, I don't want to say carved out, but definitely like a huge hollow cavern, just old pirate style of where, you know, where he keeps his loot and you know, he's got torches.
So a pirate cove.
Yeah, it's a pirate cove just embedded in the sea cave, like if what's the
Goonies.
Cliffs? The cliffs in England. What are those? The
cliffs of Dover.
Cliffs of Dover. Something like that. It's like, oh, when the sea level goes down enough, there's a hole in the cliffs of Dover. You go in and inside is just all this pirate cove. That's Tortuga, except it's just for Captain Scrap.
You know what would be interesting?
It's Tortuga, because it's for turtles.
Tortuga.
I'd be down with Tortuga. Just a few more turtle shells, maybe a pizzeria.
Right. But all made out of. I know, not the pizzeria. I was agreeing to the turtle shell part.
An industrial post-apocalyptic pirate cove. Yeah, we can work with that. That's great. Imagine like certain parts of the coastline lined with beach ships, pieces of oil rig. I mean, I'm no fucking expert on the sea or anything, you know, and if an oil rig breaks, it's probably going to plummet into the ocean, but likely sooner or later, it's going to get washed to
somewhere,
at least pieces. Like,
yeah, pieces.
And especially if the oceans are going to get as violent as we have described them.
Just imagine.
Kaiju's like, get that fucking out of here. Like, whatever. I was like, what is this, an oil rig? I'll throw it like a frisbee.
Trash washes up on the beach.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine what the trash is in the scale of a global catastrophe.
Yeah, like that. What's that giant cluster of garbage in the ocean?
Yeah, the landmass in the Pacific. Yeah,
if you get enough kaiju combat out there and you get enough sea levels going up and down and the waves,
we've also
what's
got, like,
to say that that doesn't just wash ashore and then one beach could be like that cove, or one beach could be like that dark beach that we don't really go to because it's scary. But another beach could just be a jungle of fucking junk.
And we don't have to explain everything. Like, if you want the improbability of a stack of cars coming out of the beach, make a stack of cars coming out of the beach. We'll worry about how it got there later.
Because, like, if we say, like, the half of California falls into the sea.
Yeah.
So then what's not to say that Las Vegas is barely peeking out of... I mean, I know Las Vegas is not technically there.
Well, Vegas is never going to die. Vegas is the cockroach of the Americana.
Well, Las Vegas, everything's fine in Las Vegas. People are just a little bit more tan. That's really what? The world ended? I've been in here on slots this whole time. Like, I had no idea. But, yeah.
We'll save that for an Elseworlds issue.
But literally, anything. We can do anything coming out of the ocean or anything that's on the coastline.
Well, and imagine a place like Vegas that's been destroyed and subsequently rebuilt by monsters.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So let's start hashing out a couple of locations. Not just things we want to see, but places we want to have within this block that we have created that is LDUSA. So I've written down a couple right now. We've got Glampire's Lair. We've got some ideas as to what that is. Generally, I think we're all kind of in the, like, you know, almost Gothic architecture, repurposed.
We still got to figure out, what does he live in? I mean, I know we're all kind of thinking castle. It'd be too easy to make it like a theme park.
I'm not against that at all.
Okay, but I'm not 100% against it. I'm just thinking, you're Glampire. The wasteland is yours. Do you really want to go live in Cinderella's castle? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Here's what I'm thinking. Like, I'm thinking it's some kind of a combination of fragments of a skyscraper and Googie architecture, like a little bit of, like, Frank Lloyd Wright. Like, it's this kind of, like, horrible hybrid jutting out. It's like, imagine a really posh 1970s, super stylistic, retro-futuristic swinging pad, but on, like, a skyscraper scale, like, built into the side of a mountain, but then also subsequently, like, destroyed and rebuilt several times over. It's a fusion of styles. It looks very dramatic.
Like, kind of like the reverse of what happened in Gargoyles with Xanatos' Tower, where you had that ancient Scottish castle atop a giant skyscraper.
Right. This is a mountain with, like, a bunch of
Frank Lloyd Wright shit on it.
Yeah. And it's all kind of cobbled together in weird ways. And
I know the answer to this is probably going to be no. Can we have that M.C. Escher room in there somewhere just so that we can reenact the Jareth scene from Labyrinth?
Here's the Labyrinth carryover. No. But here's the...
I knew it.
When I've been thinking about Glampire's Lair, I have been thinking about it in a perspective of there is a castle and there is all that spews out beneath it, like the Goblin City and the Labyrinth, such as it is, and so on. So, like, I feel like Glampire's domain is like that, is structured like that.
Gotcha.
So he's
like atop a butte, and then it all kind of...
Right. You can imagine Glampire's domain looking like that, but the aesthetics are just completely different.
I gotcha. No, a lot more spider, a lot more crystal.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm down with that.
I'm pretty sure I shared with you guys a website that does, like, you can mix your own ambient background sound effects.
Yes.
And I shared a Glampire throne room soundscape that I created. And when I made it, I was thinking very Gothic castle, but almost like made out of crystal. So it's got a very shiny sound to it. You can only build it out of like 500 or so sound effects that are available to you. So I even took a couple sound effects of ghosts. It's just Ooh. Something that's not that exactly, but definitely
I've
something.
Got chains.
Well, it's more like whispering, like evil whispering.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's like some place that's creepy, but you would almost think it's magic, but is it, or is it just fucking with your head sort of thing?
Gotcha.
Because another thing, we don't even know what Glampire's powers are. What does he do?
Well, everything. We have, I mean, because we have yet to do our big Glampire
right.
expose episode.
Right. So that's why I kind of threw a lot of stuff into this soundscape. So that whenever I was trying to think about Glampire stuff, I'd put the soundscape on and just try and get visuals. But that made me quickly realize we don't really have a lot of stuff on him, especially where he lives. But again, I was just erring on the side of Gothic Crystal Castle.
Another thing that we haven't really nailed down that I've got some recent ideas for is what the Lightning Dog base kind of feels like.
Right.
The SWAT Cat's Junkyard, actually, is popping into my head a lot as inspiration. Something where they're primarily underground and they've got something above ground that seems innocuous and they're able to kind of pop out of it. Nothing is ostentatious as a giant mechanical lion coming out of the side of a cliff.
Right. I'm into that. Like, because they need to be occupying some kind of a place that they can
call home.
Yeah. And I want them to be able to move around eventually, like as we said, because I like the story arc that tends to happen in various incarnations of Ninja Turtles where like they have
they
their
go
base,
a road trip.
And it's real and their base no. I mean oh. road trip sure, but like they have their base and their base is really cool. And then eventually they have to leave that home just like and then come up with another base that's even cooler. And so on, and then maybe go back to their old base. When
and then somehow wind up in upstate New York.
They have different locations. Mm-hmm. Like when in Ninja Turtles 2, the film, like where they discover
the subway station.
The subway station. Like that was a really cool moment. People have come back to that, like even though it's a shitty movie. That
Not
was a
as
cool
bad
thing.
As 3.
It's subjective. But anyhow, it's a cool thing to be able to have like move around like that. We have to create a place that feels good. It feels like a right home. And I think, you know, a facility kind of area would be good. They can't live above ground. Like, they have to be in secret, but I don't know if we're ready for them to have a fully concealed hangar in any kind of professional sense, like the Blackbird coming out from beneath the basketball court.
Area 51.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm not mad at that. I am actually, that, wow.
Okay, well, what if it was like Area 51? What if it was that NORAD kind of facility, the one built into the mountain?
That yeah, I can't remember the name, but I know the one you're talking about.
Because Area 51 is kind of like a hide in broad daylight kind of thing. The only thing keeping you out of there is the fact that there's Blackhawks.
Yeah, there's that rumored other like Site B to Area 51 that's in the mountains.
Mm.
There's that, but the NORAD one, the one, what's that one place? I think it's in the Appalachian Mountains where they store all the really old films so that if there ever actually was a nuclear apocalypse, that stuff would be safe. It's like there's priceless pieces of art. There's like original prototypes of other technology and stuff. This is a real place, mind you. It's like super deep in this mountain.
Richie Rich's family heirloom.
I believe we're talking about the same place. I mean,
we might be.
NORAD is the command center built into the side of a mountain. It goes deep. People live in there, subterranean lifestyles. The government has a lot of facilities that are in there. I don't know if they're storing like precious artifacts in there as well. But
and I don't mean artifacts like Indiana Jones stuff. I mean, like literally they have like an original print of Gone with the Wind. And other pieces of art that we consider part of our culture.
It belongs in a museum.
Yeah, they have it preserved in there literally in case there's a nuclear apocalypse and they want something to find it later. It'd be interesting if that something is the Lightning Dogs.
I mean, that might be like a good secondary thing because that's an awful lot about human culture that's to be gifted to the Lightning Dogs early on.
Right, that's true. The other thing
to tie into your point about Area 51 being hiding in plain sight, obviously they're not going to be there. As it stands right now, this would be a facility largely destroyed that Glampire and his minions would have completely ransacked. So why would they think to look for the Lightning Dogs there? And it would be somewhat entertaining to have these extraterrestrials hiding out in the base where extraterrestrials are supposed to be.
I think what we're realizing here is that, yeah, they may start off kind of lost and they can have a temporary home base. But with Glampire way too close for comfort, there's no chance that they can
stay there forever.
So they're going to have to go on the road, and they're going to be on the road for a long time. And that's when they're going to start meeting up different new friends,
new enemies.
And they're gonna, brand new season, tune in this fall. They're going to have a lot of different places where they're going to call home for a temporary time, maybe in Area 51, maybe the NORAD mountain base. But at the end of the day, they're going to have to realize there is no place like home. They got to get back to Domus.
They got to run as a pack to get there.
Yeah, and they have to meet Glampire head on because he's squatting right on top of the last Farfetch. And it's not a working Farfetch. It's a destroyed one, but there's no chance unless they stop him.
I mean, insofar as the discussion about like locations and bases and everything, like what we really need to do is we really need to continue stockpiling reference material and going through all that in our respective like depositories of all these files. There's so many things to mine, like the modern day castles, that real estate website that's all like nuclear silos and everything. Because the dogs will be on the road for a time, as they won't know where they're going to go immediately after that. And only through like the aid of like Wolfman Jack and other things will be able to figure out like, you know, where they can go to find some kind of shelter and how to build it up to like protect themselves and so on. We need to take inspiration from the desolate places out of Russia, the abandoned spaceports. Overgrown.
That airport that was built like 3 years ago, right before a crash, and it's an international airport and completely abandoned.
Now, see, yeah, like even having an airport where they do their car stuff could be interesting. There's so many options, so we need to be able to like spread all these options out on the table, digitally speaking, and explore that. And in the meantime, just to paint our own vistas, like less so sketch and more so like anything that we can do in broad strokes. Because like when we're at this conceptual level, precision is going to hurt us. We need to have like rough ideas. You know, when you're conceptualizing anything, especially something that involves like an alien world or something, you know, George Lucas might say, okay, well, I'm designing Naboo. And Naboo, it's very sort of Italian Renaissance inspired, very lovely place. It's kind of an Edenic planet, like height of architecture and artwork, very Baroque almost in how lavish everything is. That's all he gives them. He's not a concept artist himself. And then the people go off and they create the vistas for like the main city in Naboo, and like there'll be a city, there'll be some forests. We already have right now anything that a creator like George Lucas would already be giving to his design team. For him to then be like, okay, so make as many pictures as possible, and then I'll pick the ones that I like or ones that I think is cool enough to develop a sequence around. We're at that point right now. And so that's why I'm saying we don't need to worry about these specifics, because specifics could harm our creativity in a lot of sense here.
Yeah.
We need to know, like, we know that the wasteland is a desolated America. Mm-hmm. We know we want to focus on a desert landscape here.
Mm-hmm.
So go. There's peopleoids, there's monsters. There's maybe an ocean somewhere not too far away, within 100 miles, 200 miles, and lots of places for people to drive like kick-ass hot rods. Like a place where you grow crystals, is it subterranean, is it above ground? Doesn't really matter as long as it's cool looking. We have all the possibilities here. We just need to give ourselves, one, the time to sit down and really think about these things on our independent time to then come together again, and two, the time to create them fully, like visually. Or in Doug's case, probably notes or something, you know, whatever works. We got a lot of opportunities here. And I think the best thing to do is to treat it like it would be for any film or television series, and take these pitches and like develop them from there. Because, you know, really, if you want set locations, then the best thing to do would be to start writing scripts and be like, all right, well, we need this. But right now we need to go overview, which means we need loose sketches of vistas. We need scenic stuff.
Yeah.
And that's something I can do. It's not something I do often, because characters are more fun to draw. But we need to get used to doing the scenic stuff and look at like all the production artwork that Mobius did. You know, he's got a lot of great character work, but that's a guy who does some like crazy scapes. You'll see like, you know, you might see like a skiff going across the scenery, but then you'll see the landscape and how it moves and all that. And like, that's the stuff that turns into the world. That's the stuff we need to do. That's why I don't think we can pin it down much more, because we really need our imaginations to do that for us, not our words.
What I was going for more than necessarily trying to pin it down was, at least for my part, a little bit more direction. Part of it could just be because I've done so much commission work for so long that I work better within a box.
Yeah.
I was looking for a couple other boundaries, just a couple other things for me to ping off.
Yeah, no, I got you. I understand. Everybody works differently, and it's hard to figure out how to make that work.
A lot of the character stuff I can still do, because I've done character design for here, there, and everywhere. But world building the way that I did, say, back when I was in high school, I'm a long way from there. So I have been kind of restricting myself to what others have requested of me, both for the work I've done for Nerdy Show and also for outside places.
Yeah.
And I like playing in a confined box because then it's like, okay, here are the rules. What can I do to twist it in a way that might not be expected and still present what people are asking of me?
Yeah, I get that. You know, I could say, go to Tumblr, go to all the blogs that follow ruined, desolate spaces and just
play with it
and click through until you have an idea.
Like I said, I was wanting to get an idea of a couple of locales to kick around because I feel like we've done a lot of broad strokes for the area these guys are going to be playing around with. And I wanted to just get an idea as to where to shine a light to try and start to develop those areas a little bit more richly. And we can figure out how, say, the map connects to each other later.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got enough to go on to get started, especially Captain Scrap's thing. I really like the idea of almost an inverted spider's web or Glampire's lair, whereas it's generally something that, you know, the edges are the touch points and then it's connected in the center. Versus what Glampire's Lair could be, where the epicenter is at the top of a giant thing. It's almost like a spider's web has been laid down on top of something, and it's like a blanket with a focal point.
Sure, yeah.
There's some cool stuff to go with. I just was, in talking with me, I'm sure you've noticed, Cap, that I tend to free associate when there's nothing else going on, and there's a lot of things that come to mind.
Whee! Yeah, I'm sorry, man. We all work differently. So I guess, Well, you got the short list. If all else fails, there's that.
Okay.
This is but the first step into a much larger world.
But with all this open road, we've got to have some vehicles to get around. Some kind of trademark hot rods have been part of the Lightning Dogs concept since the beginning, but up to this point, we hadn't really cemented anything. However, as luck would have it, the man responsible for the first Lightning Dogs fan art is a gearhead with a penchant for vehicle design, as evidenced by a hot little number that appeared one day in our Lightning Dogs forum thread.
You know, it's funny. Max Acree did the dog catcher, which is an idea that I pitched in like the second episode and all you motherfuckers shot down. And that's essentially what I was picturing.
Well, hold on a second. Hold on. Now Max isn't here to back himself up, but Doug and I did talk to Max and
we said, don't do anything Tony says ever again. No, I'm joking. No,
God damn it.
It was actually really, it was really cool. But I'll let Cap finish.
He's a guy who knows a lot about vehicles. Mm-hmm. And as you may know, we don't know
absolutely
a lot about vehicles. So we've talked to him about him coming in to work with us to create the Lightning Dogs vehicles. Now, as the dog catcher, I want you to know, Tony, I still wasn't hot on the idea.
Okay, that's fair.
I think it is too on the nose. However, if I look at his car design and take away the fact that it is a dog catching vehicle, it had enough. I was like, look at this thing. If we just add some more stuff on it and take some stuff away, we got ourselves a vehicle right here.
Uh-huh.
And also, I think maybe a dog catcher vehicle for the enemies would be a little bit more apropos. And we could call it the dog catcher as far as action figure speak
right,
goes.
Right, yeah,
but
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, it basically is a prison. It's a truck prison thing.
Now, you see, I would say that that's too on the nose. That them repurposing it and using it for their own stuff and just tricking it out like a badass hot rod, exactly as Max did it. You're a beautiful man, Max Acree.
Hold on.
It's like the catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I'm not really saying it's a dog. I'm not saying it's a dog catcher car, like a straight up dog catcher car, because I think that is too on the nose.
Okay.
But a mobile prison unit with like a big grabbing hand called the dog catcher that they made purposely.
Okay.
Like, that, let's get the Lightning Dogs.
Yeah.
That's what's in my mind.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. No, and I'd be down with that. All this like crystal tech, like bonded to the side of it.
I don't know if crystal prison bars are too much. I mean, that might actually like supercharge somebody. Who knows?
Well, it's crystal prison. Yeah, it's like you put someone in the crystal prison and then like they get supercharged, then they explode out of there. And Glampire's like, so let me get this straight. The Lightning Dogs.
Whose power?
Them. Their power's based off of the crystals that exploded.
And what did you put them in?
You surrounded them with crystals that you took from my crystal field. And now they're gone.
We don't know if they actually get amped from the crystals. In fact, they probably shouldn't.
Yeah, they shouldn't probably. Except for Kid. She could probably walk over.
Well, she would be.
She could walk over to the crystals and like put her hands on the bars and then charge them to where they would vibrate and then explode. And
well,
then they could get out.
Because who else would you put in that prison? Who would seem weak enough to just put them in a crystal prison? Put Kid.
Not Angela.
That's
Angela,
powerless.
Angela could break through it. Dingo could probably shout through it. Pierre, you just can't catch him. King Corso, maybe. Because he's not really, I mean, he's
yeah, but he's in cahoots at this point.
True.
All dubious crystalline entrapments aside, before Max could formally start to work concepting cars, he had a critical question that concerned the overall visual representation of Lightning Dogs as a whole.
Max was talking with us in an email as far as like, well, before I, you know, start designing vehicles and so on, in order to not need to like work backwards at any point, think about what the overall style visually of Lightning Dogs is. So I've been thinking about that for the past week now, and what I would like to propose is a style focusing on the heavy blacks as seen in early mid 90s animation, specifically
SWAT Cats.
SWAT Cats, Gargoyles, Mighty Max, that commercial for Secret of Evermore. I don't know if he has frame reference for that, but it's really cool.
I'm also entirely down with all of that. It's kind of funny because I've experimented with a more heavy black style like that, particularly when I was doing the second, when I'm continuing to do the second issue of Jamella.
Mm.
All that stuff underground, I was trying to play around with it a little bit more. So I think it'll work for it very well. It kind of evokes that sort of graphic sensibility.
And is also really good for desolate places.
Oh, yeah.
Like then you see it, you feel it. And as far as like, you know, the level of detail in the world, the style detail, I mean, I think with your character designs for the characters, that has a good feel for as many lines as we would expect. If this were an animation, that's as many lines as we would expect would be featured on these characters and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We're obviously not animating in the style I draw in. Like, probably no one should ever do that.
There's one person who used to, and that was the gentleman who, I think, was it Ralph Bakshi?
Yeah, Bakshi, I mean, yeah, he likes to keep things dirty.
I'm thinking specifically of the Raggedy Ann and Andy movie.
Shit, did Bakshi do that?
I think it was, and it was, I mean, lavish, gorgeous stuff. Because did Bakshi do Cool World?
Yeah.
Then yes, he also did the Raggedy Ann and Andy movie.
Actually, and it pains me to say this, I was wrong. It wasn't Ralph Bakshi who did the Raggedy Ann and Andy movie. It was legendary animator Richard Williams, best known for Who Framed Roger Rabbit and the pinnacle of hand-drawn animation, The Thief and the Cobbler. Raggedy Ann and Andy, a musical adventure, has actually never been released outside of VHS and RCA video disc. But check out this episode's page for a link to where you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. And if you've only ever seen the commercially available Thief and the Cobbler, allow us to direct you to the recobbled cut, which restores Richard Williams' far superior originally intended version. There's nothing else like it, except for maybe Disney's Aladdin, which ripped it off quite a bit. But that is a very complicated story, which, not coincidentally, is the subject of a documentary that we'll also link to. Cliff Notes, it's a beautiful mess where the film that got ripped off wound up getting ripped off by the film that ripped it off to become The Thief and the Cobbler. But all that aside, during this recording, we never figured out that it was Richard Williams I was initially meaning, and we kept on talking about Ralph Bakshi. Bakshi is great, but so is Richard Williams, and he doesn't get enough love. So anyway, here's us talking about Bakshi instead.
If we could make Lightning Dogs look like Bakshi, particularly some of his kind of cityscape stuff, like American Pop or something, with like rotoscoped people walking down dirty streets, I would lose my mind, but I got the feeling we're not going to be able to take it there.
We'll wait until the episode where Pierre eats some psychedelic things, because every cartoon show has something like that when it's aiming for our demographic, and we'll incorporate it in there.
It's not exactly reminiscent of the heavy black style, but I think it has a good feel for how much detail goes into character design, but then also a great level of detail that goes into the backgrounds and vehicles and so on. And I know it's a high bar, but I really think we should shoot for it. Akira.
Oh, fuck.
That's like saying, look, I know it's a really high bar, but I think we need to be the best thing that ever happened. Like, it's like,
no, I know, but I mean, like, when,
holy God,
when we show something at a scale, like a massive scale, it should be as impressive as when we see an establishing shot in Akira. You know, it should be that detailed. The characters, they don't have to move much.
I am just going to say that even, because what you're describing, there's a brilliant YouTube video out there saying why Akira is one of the most important films in cinematic history, where it shows you a cityscape, a lavishly painted cityscape with lights on in every window, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And it's one of 8 layers that shows up in a 5-second shot.
Yes.
And it's the one furthest removed from anything and everything that's going on that you see a half a glimpse of.
Yes. No, I know it's extreme, but that's just, as far as the style guide, I'm talking about, like, as far as, like, if we're looking at a still image of Lightning Dogs, because we're nowhere near ready to animate this thing. Just looking at a still image of it, and we're seeing, like, the characters, you know, move around, like, the line quality, the width of line and everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm talking about. And with backgrounds, I would love to see shots that could show off scale in the same way Akira does. Now, we're not going to be legitimately at that level, not in a million billion years. Of course, there's so much more we can do now, cheaply and simply, than they were able to do then. But
I hear where you're coming from, and it is an exceptionally high bar, but it is something that I also think it is worth striving
for. We look at it and we're like, all right, how am I going to do the budget version of that? We'll still be pretty good.
We're going to Swede Akira backgrounds.
I wouldn't say Swede, but
I mean, and this probably points to us needing someone who
actually does that kind of background painting full time, because neither you, we're talking about doing these vistas and stuff, neither you nor I spend much time doing anything like that at all.
A lot of people like to complain about, say, drawing hands. I have no problem with it, but I have, feel like I'm drawing hands when I try and draw backgrounds, because it's like, this doesn't look right.
You work in very fine, precise lines, and doing this kind of concept art, at least to start with, is impressionistic.
Yeah, and that breaks me a little bit.
Right.
It breaks me, because it's like, no, it's not right. Something's not right. I gotta find this.
This might be another opportunity where we need to find more people to collaborate with to really bring this to life. But that's, we're building a team. So
on the flip side of it too, this is an excellent opportunity for me to grow as an artist. So I can't neglect that either.
And this is sort of thing where we might want to create an impression of a scene with color before we add detail to even decide what it is. It's a bunch of different ways of thinking. It's a bunch of different artistic disciplines that we're winging, because we all have our various expertise and this isn't one of them. And this is just to help give us more ideas for the possibilities of the world. Because Doug and I could start cranking out scripts basically as soon as we know the background of the world. But, here we are.
Here we are. Aru.
Aru.
Hashtag Howl Noise.
Does that conclude this episode of Lightning Dogs?
I think so. That does conclude this episode of Lightning Dogs. Because I the creative juices, I wouldn't say they've all been squeezed out, but they have definitely blown their load.
Okay.
Colorful imagery, ladies and gentlemen. In our next episode, we bring on two other artists. But no, neither of them are adept at scenic concept art either. It's actually something we're still in need of, though Cap has done a couple of pieces that mimic the style of animated backgrounds from the cartoons of that era, and we'll link to those on this episode's page. Something that's been a big source of inspiration for the locales of Lightning Dogs is the sci-fi art and 80s airbrushed goodness that we repost over on the Lightning Dogs Tumblr page at lightningdogs.tumblr.com. So much of it is representative of what we're looking for that it's kept us warm on lonely nights while we've busied ourselves with other facets of development. That said, we're past ready to pull someone in to help us further define the look of the Lightning Dogs world. There are a couple of artists that we've got our eyes on, but if you know of any quality folks with a knack for sci-fi scenery, shoot us a message. But before we can bring anyone on, we'll need to be able to pay such a person. That's why we're working towards a goal of $200 a month to ensure we can continue to afford the assistance of awesome freelance artists, such as Max Acree and this hypothetical future landscape artist. Head to patreon.com/lightningdogs to join up. You'll become a member of the pack and get access to lots of behind-the-scenes content like full sketchbook pages, and very soon, a side podcast called The Wasteland Drive-In, where we watch films that we suspect will inspire new ideas for Lightning Dogs and share our takeaways. Things like Treasure Planet, the obscure Mark Hamill and Bill Paxton movie Slipstream, and Ralph Bakshi's Wizards. Anyways, all that and lots more at patreon.com/lightningdogs. Become a member of the pack, like our latest recruit, Onua. That's not all for community news. We've got an awesome new piece of fan art. Temsu commissioned artist Sean Moore to do a full body portrait of Kid, wearing her spark plug necklace, no less. It's very cool and one of the many pieces of artwork we'll be linking to on this episode's page. Also, you might remember a recent mention of a joke character, Chihuahua. Well, we recently figured out a way to actually integrate him into Lightning Dogs that's more than a little bit awesome. If you're down for some Chihuahua spoilers, we've got a link for you. Don't forget to spread the word about Lightning Dogs by telling a friend or rating and reviewing us on iTunes. I'm happy to say that thanks to that last push from you fine folks, we finally got a publicly listed rating. But we can't stop there. It takes hundreds of ratings to get the heat on iTunes, and we've got 7. So if you can, please, take the time to give us a 5-star rating or a short review. And if you're in need of a how-to, we've got you covered. Just go to nerdyshow.com/spread the word. And on one final note, we need to address the giant irradiated pachyderm in the room. You'll hear us throw out the word kaiju a lot. As one of our most loyal members of the pack, Big Bad Shadow Man, pointed out, that's not actually correct. And let's face it, we're nerds. We gotta get this shit right. Daikaiju is the proper term for giant monster, while kaiju refers to just the film genre itself. The more you know, just imagine that we're saying it correctly from now on, because we're gonna get it wrong. A lot. Anyway, that's enough yipping and yapping. We'll see you in the new year with new ongoing adventures of The Lightning Dogs! Pound sign. Howl noise.
Pound sign, howl noise. A pound sign!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.